you'll be coming back to me, coming back to where you wanna be. And the time that you've been gone will vanish like the song sung by the rain.
My friends, it thrills me to say goodnight to you over the radio airwaves, the FM airwaves right now. WFMU is once again broadcasting over its terrestrial airwaves from 91.1 FM. Our transmitter is back up. I've been Scott. Thank you so much for being here with me today. Our return terrestrial broadcasting this afternoon. Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, worldwide, WFMU.org. Thanks to all the folks who've pledged and put me over the top and put the station over the top today, but please do keep pledging. We really, really are in a rough time right now. Minnie Riperton, the great Minnie Riperton, ending today's program from Perfect Angel, the track Our Lives. Cellar, Eye Anatomy, the double LP, beautiful double LP. We heard Experiences of Insight and Untimeliness. We heard Robust Worlds from Emotional Planet. The track was Human Stomp. Holy Balm did Take It from It's You. We heard Dennis Bush, White Light, Black Hole from Total Youth. BB Jr., two tracks, Temple Walls / First War. That's one track, actually. Tearjerker, the name of the LP. LP from Les Morts Vont Bien with a track called Das Leben ist so Schwarz. Cargo Cultus did Stick at No Scruples. Andy Stott with Up the Box from Luxury Problems. And two glimpses of a Mitley future at the top of the set. Rappin' Rabbit and Marge Champion and Colleen Townsend Evans imploring, Lord, send me an African maid. Please vote tomorrow, my friends. Freeform Radio, stay tuned. Benjamin Walker's Too Much Information is coming right up. Bye, everybody.
since this radio program airs on Monday nights, I had big plans for a special episode that would air the Monday evening before Election Day. This special episode was going to be so special, I thought it just might change the course of the election itself. I've been working on this episode for months now, and there have been trips across the globe, secret recordings. Trust me, it was going to be epic. I was going to call it October Surprise. But then, well, hurricane or superstorm or Frankenstorm or whatever the f*** it was, Sandy hit, and everything got messed up. My show is in tatters. Sandy, it turns out, is the real October Surprise. So I decided to call up a few folks I know and talk to them about the upcoming election and Sandy. Cartoonist Adrian Tomina lives in Park Slope, Brooklyn. He did the cover for this week's New Yorker. It references both Sandy and the election. So, Adrian, tell me about your Sandy experience.
Well, I think, you know, the strangest aspect of it all to me was just how different of an experience you could have had last week, depending on like a quarter of a mile, you know. You know, we're not that far from Dumbo and Red Hook, and so to compare the experience of someone there versus someone in our neighborhood is pretty incredible. And you know, I was just sitting in front of my computer all night watching stuff on the internet and looking at people's Twitter feeds and things like that.
Yeah, I was doing that too until the power went out.
Right, yeah. Well, that was the expectation. I was like, at any minute, everything's just going to go dark, and then it'll sort of, you know, change the perspective even more dramatically all of a sudden. But
yeah.
You know, it was just odd that in our neighborhood, which is obviously at a higher elevation, it didn't actually even feel like that dramatic of a storm. Like, it wasn't raining very much where we were. There were a few gusts of wind, but nothing that if I hadn't been connected to the world through technology, I would have just thought, it's just kind of a stormy night outside.
So once it did go out, so I remember, I think it was around 6 o'clock. So the problem was I got the flu that morning. I knew I was getting sick, so I crawled into bed. And, you know, I had a couple bottles of orange juice and stuff near the bed, and I was, you know, taking a bunch of medicines. But then I had the iPhone, and I was just scrolling through Twitter looking at stuff. And then I wrote to someone who said, "How's it going in the East Village?" And I wrote, "Oh, it's fine. We still have power." And then, like, 5 minutes later, the power went out.
Yeah.
Which
it's amazing.
Which was fun. So I'm curious, when you knew that the power was out for so much of the city, like, what was going on Twitter? Like, what were you looking at? Were you looking at pictures of stuff? Like, were you just...
Yeah, I was, anyone who could put a little photo up or a little video, that was interesting to me. I mean, and just to see it kind of unfold in real time, or just, you know, with a slight delay, I couldn't believe it. I was looking, you know, you're somewhat guided by things that you have more of a personal connection to. So I was especially shocked to watch the waters roll in Red Hook and Dumbo. I was, you know, like, looking at the Twitter feeds of certain stores or restaurants or whatever that I was familiar with, and basically realizing that they were going to get hit pretty hard. You know, my daughter loves that kind of antique carousel down by the bridge.
Uh-huh.
And so someone posted this amazing photo of it, just like the lights were still on in it, but the water was almost like all the way halfway up the height of the entire carousel, and it was just like glowing in this ocean.
Did you show her this picture?
No, because the next morning or 2 days later, the owner came online and said that it's going to be okay, that there was some damage, but it's going to be up and running again. So
you didn't like want to scare her with that?
No. She didn't even know. I mean, the thing that I thought was just in this neighborhood that was most troubling was to see like the anticipatory panic and fear that sort of spread through everyone, and to see. you know, I mean, like right now there's like this kind of tremendous feeling of community and goodwill that's going through New York, and people are helping each other out, and we're all kind of patting each other on the back a little bit. But I got to say that I got this little glimmer of the opposite of that in the days leading up to the storm, where people were hoarding groceries and would snatch the last bottle of water out from someone at the grocery store.
Well, I saw it, like, you know, as it was happening. I finally dragged myself out of bed on Tuesday, and, you know, so the power is still out. And, you know, the images I saw really stuck with me. There was a pizza place at, like, First and St. Mark's, and it was, mm-hmm. it's full of kids, like, gnawing on cold pizza. They were selling cold pizza, and it's just like they were rats. And then up by NYU, which had generators,
yeah.
so they had power, there was just, like, all kind of people hoarding around the entrances because they have actually outlets in the walls.
So they're trying to plug in their phones?
No. There was a giant fat guy with, like, charging his two iPads, like, sort of, like, doing body interference on, like, all these young girls who, like, just wanted to, like, charge their phone.
Yeah. it's amazing how what a slippery slope it is into, like, you know, I mean, I was having brunch with some people yesterday, and they were talking about how they're even still trying to ration out the gas that they have remaining in the tanks of their cars because they work upstate, or, you know, all this stuff that they have to calculate out. And I was just thinking, like, if this goes on a little bit longer, we're going to start fighting in Thunderdome. You know, it's like people will kill you so that they can charge up their iPad.
This is why I stayed inside. There was one thought I had, though, at night. I really wished I had the strength to get out of bed and go to the bridge and look at the city, like, half in the dark. I really, and I still haven't had the time to go online and
look. Yeah, the photos are amazing. Like, to see, like, the bridge illuminated exactly halfway across, and just the cover of New York magazine this week has a great photo, kind of an aerial photo of Manhattan and the lower half completely.
Oh, yeah. No, that's one of the reasons why I haven't bothered to go online to look for more, because that one kind of sums it up. It's beautiful. Yeah.
Yeah.
But Adrian, I want to talk to you about another great cover that's on the newsstands this week, which is the one you did for the New Yorker magazine,
right.
which is also Sandy related. And it's already gone viral. I've seen it posted all over on the internet. But mm-hmm. can you describe it for us here?
It's a mostly black cover, and it's got a very small image of a guy kind of crawling through some floodwaters with a flashlight, basically searching for his polling place.
Yeah, but there's, like, you can't really see. So it's very, very dark, and you've got, like, a submerged taxi cab in the distance. So that's how you can kind of tell, like, how deep the waters are.
Yeah, there's a submerged cab, and also if you look, this is one of those things that gets kind of lost in the digital version of it. But I think when the print version comes out, also floating on top of the water is a little Metro card too. And then the guy's kind of up to his armpits in dark water.
And he's got a flashlight, and he's the light is shining on a wall, and just tell us what's on the wall.
Yeah, it's the standard multilingual polling place sign that we see all around the city with a black arrow in the middle, and then three or four different languages saying vote here.
Yeah. So it combines Sandy and the election. And was this something, you know, when you were online looking at, you know, all the stuff that was going on, as you just described, were you thinking about Sandy plus the election from the beginning?
Yeah, I was, but not in terms of, I'm not enough of a pro, right? I instantly look at any kind of news item and try and translate it in my mind into a New Yorker cover. Those two things were already combining in my mind, but more just in terms of on a human level, in terms of how is this going to affect the election, and then starting to think about how if I had any glimmer of hope at that moment, it was that maybe that this storm would sort of point people in a certain direction in terms of the election too, in terms of who's going to acknowledge climate change and things like that. And there was also a lot of kind of I felt like during the run-up to this election, there was a lot of hypothetical kind of debates thrown around about is Obama an effective enough leader, and what if there was a natural disaster? Would he be able to handle it well? And do we need to spend money on FEMA anymore? And things like that. And so as this was all unfolding, I was sort of thinking, you know, this is, I mean, obviously everyone's immediate concern should be survival and taking care of each other and everything, but this also seems like it's going to, I'm hoping it will have some repercussions in terms of the election as well.
Yeah, but it's kind of like the greatest October surprise in the history of October surprises, though, really.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, when you have, when people are looking at images of Chris Christie shaking hands with Obama, and, you know, I mean, it's kind of stuff that people never could have predicted even 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, but with your cover, I mean, I felt like even when I was in the dark during this week, writhing in pain and hallucinating, you know, grim thoughts because of the flu, I think that I was worried that perhaps that the East Coast being whacked from Sandy, it would affect the voting in the sense that, you know, these traditional sort of locked-in blue states would lose a lot of votes because, as the guy on the cover that you drew, he can't maybe find where to vote.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's still as much of a risk as it is as it is a boost, because I mean, I know many polling places in New York are getting switched at the last minute, and so
Tents. I hear we're going to be voting in tents.
Yeah, and you know, for someone like me who works from home, if I get to my normal polling place and they say, "Oh no, you're actually at some place in another neighborhood," you know, I can start walking and I'll go take care of it. But there are some people who can take off an hour from their job, especially now if they're, you know, a waiter and they've lost all of their tips from last week. That's not money that you recoup; it's just gone. You know,
yeah.
So maybe they have their lunch break and they get to their polling place and it's been moved. You know, it's not. It's not perfect, that's for sure.
No. So now, we've actually had Françoise Moulet, the cover art editor for The New Yorker, on the program before, and she's talked about her process and how she works with artists for the covers. But I'd love to take this opportunity to hear your version of how this works as an artist.
Well, it sort of depends on which cover we're talking about. But
like this new one. I mean, I would imagine it must have been insanely competitive. I mean, in the context of Sandy, where, you know, you have a New York event that's national headline news. I mean, you can't be the only artist who said, "Wow, I've got a great idea for this
week."
Yeah,
I don't know. I think one of Françoise's many gifts is she sort of shields us all from that kind of knowledge. Like, if my cover doesn't get picked, I don't know the machinations behind the scenes that led to mine not getting picked. But
I mean, I guess, is it as simple as you were there first? You like just showed up, you know, you had power.
I don't know. You know, the funny thing is I actually have had a different cover for The New Yorker that's been in their hands for a long time now. And it's been repeatedly bumped, usually by some combination of Mitt Romney and Barry Blitt, the cover artist who's been doing so many election related covers. Because it's sort of like they're planning on running mine, and then Mitt Romney's 47% video leaked, and then so suddenly Barry Blitt was able to churn out something related to that. And
so you bumped someone, so you can feel good that you probably bumped somebody this week.
Well, I bumped myself. That's the funny thing. So finally, this week, my much delayed cover, which is related to the Barclays Arena here in Brooklyn, and the Nets. Anyway, it was supposed to finally run this week, and Françoise actually called me from Paris. She was actually in Paris and said, "Well, it looks like because of this storm, your cover's going to get bumped once again, but we don't have anything yet either. So if you want to try and bump yourself, you have basically today to submit some ideas."
Wow. Wow. So she gave you the opportunity to kill yourself.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is fine. It's more palatable when it's my own fault.
And so did this help sort of having a deadline? Like, you knew like this was break it or make it or break it. You know, you had a day to do this.
Yeah. You know, I think that most of my New Yorker covers, well, all of them, except for this one, have not been timely in any way.
Yeah. Or political.
Or anything. And so it was sort of like I had all the time in the world to waste on them. I would fret over every little detail, and I'd make them very complicated in terms of all the background details and try and fill it with detail and things like that. And, you know, sometimes I'd sit there looking at the colors on the computer screen for days, making tiny little adjustments. And with this one, I had an hour to sketch out the idea and get it sent in to her. And then I had a day to draw and color the whole thing. And I think in some ways that helped me. It's my least overworked and least overthought cover, for sure.
This is why it's all dark, too.
Oh, yeah. That was very strategic. It was sort of, I knew that I wasn't going to be able to draw a whole scene of New York architecture in three-point perspective and all that kind of stuff. So there was some advanced planning, too.
Yeah, but come on. If you didn't have this great idea, it wouldn't have happened. So was this the first one that you came up with?
It was the only one, yeah. I said I have basically enough time to, like, even physically draw one sketch. So I did that and sent that in. And
oh, that's great.
Yeah, I mean, I thought this is what's coming to mind right now, and if someone comes up with something better, then I understand. But I'm not gonna be able to improve upon this in the next few minutes.
You know, it's interesting because your version of the process kind of does match the one that she has. She really is a genius at sort of pairing up, you know, ideas and artists and cartoonists. I mean, obviously with her background, I mean she knows this stuff so well. But yeah,
well, you know, she's always I feel like she's always been a good gauge of, well, she's been very generous, but also kind of intuitive in terms of gauging my abilities. I mean, you know, she was the, you know, she kind of pushed me towards doing my first cover for The New Yorker back in 2004. And it seemed like she had sort of waited a few years to watch me do stuff inside the magazine before inviting me to submit work for the cover. And, you know, and she's so far selected me for covers with themes that matched well with my style. And yeah. And I think in this case, she sort of took a little bit of a risk. But, you know, it wasn't like she wasn't asking me to do something that was going to be impossible. It was just something new and a new challenge. And she had faith in me. So that was incredible.
So Adrian, you have a new book out from your publisher, Drawn and Quarterly. It's called New York Drawings, and
Right. It's
got probably your most iconic cover, which I think is the first, the one you were just talking about,
Right. On
the cover of the book, which is an amazing iconic image hanging on the walls of apartments from Williamsburg to Tacoma. But I'm sure it's probably even tattooed on someone out there. But
it actually is. I've seen the picture of it.
Oh God. Oh God. Can you talk about this one? Describe it for us, and I'd love to hear, you know, quickly why you think this one, you know, became so iconic so quickly.
Yeah, it's at this point it's probably the image of mine that's been seen the most, or by the widest range of people. And it's just a scene inside a New York subway, and there's a woman reading a book, and she's looking out into the darkness of the subway tunnel, and there's another train adjacent to hers, and through that window you see a guy in there reading the similar book, and they're sort of locking eyes for a split second. And that's one of those things that I think would be more likely to occur to someone who had just moved to New York. That was one of the first assignments I did after moving to New York from California. And, you know, I think after you've lived here for a little while, you think of the subway ride as a time to get caught up on some reading or sleep or listen to your music or whatever. But for me, I was still, you know, looking out the window all the time and sort of noticing that every once in a while, two trains will sort of synchronize and move at the same speed for a few seconds, and you'll have this very clear line of view into the next train over. And that was the start of that idea, and I have to give Françoise credit for what ended up being kind of like the most memorable little detail of that, which is I had drawn it with just the emphasis on the two people kind of locking eyes, looking up from their books. And she suggested that I put in a little bit of detail in the drawing to show that they were actually holding the same book. That's been one of the things that people remember about that.
They're identifying, you know, their shared interest by their same consumer purchases.
Yeah, well, that's important to young people.
But, all right, obviously there's something about this image. Someone has this tattooed on their body. What do you think it is?
I guess it might be... I think a lot of my work in general, and especially my New Yorker covers, there's always a little bit of a implication of sarcasm or cynicism or something. I mean, there's one that shows like the life cycle of a book from a woman writing it to it being published and printed and sold in stores and a guy reading it. And eventually he puts it out on a stoop and some homeless guys use it to light on fire and warm their hands over. So things like that have sort of a slightly darker undertone or something. And I think this one was an anomaly in that it's basically very sweet and kind of romantic in a way. And I think, people like sweet and romantic.
Yeah, it's important to the kids.
Yes.
I get that. Now, one of the things you talk about in your book is that, you know, you're actually quite proud of the commercial work that you've done and that you do. But it seems rare. I've met a lot of cartoonists.
It depends on which commercial work we're talking about.
I know, but hold on. We know a lot of cartoonists who seem to really hate working for the man and and drawing anything other than their own comics.
Yeah.
Is it just because it's the New Yorker, or have you always loved doing commercial work?
No, I haven't always loved it, and there's still a lot of jobs that I've taken on that have been pretty mercenary, you know, just...
But not the cover for the Yola Tengo CD, right? That's also in the book, because, you
right,
know,
right.
Which takes place in the WFMU studios. That you love doing that one.
There's actually a second volume that they have. I've already done the artwork for the second CD of their fundraiser.
Okay,
songs.
Good.
They just haven't put it out yet.
You like doing that one?
I do. It continues that story, actually, from the cover of the first album.
Oh, good.
I think there's the fact that, you know, I'm a fan of the New Yorker as a reader, and that I have a really pleasant and friendly working relationship with a handful of people there that we've sort of developed over the years. So a lot of the frustrations of that relationship between illustrator and art director and editor are eradicated because we kind of know what to expect from each other. But I've totally been on that same page, like you described, of being the independent artist who feels that everything else is a distraction from his real work and all that. But that changed for me quite a bit when I became a parent a few years ago, and a lot of our friends started having kids, and I started to see some of these pretty dramatic choices that people were making in order to have enough money to be a family in New York, you know, moving to places that they wouldn't necessarily want to live, and making a lot of personal sacrifices and things like that. And so suddenly I viewed every New Yorker assignment as just a really luxurious way to make some money and to be a part of a magazine that I'm a fan of, you know. And I think that's made me more appealing as an artist to work with too, from the employer's point of view. You know, I think I used to have sort of a chip on my shoulder where I'd be almost annoyed that they were asking me to do
an how assignment. Dare you?
Yeah, how dare you intrude on the great artist's personal work?
Well, it's a great book, and there really are a lot of great images in it. And
thank you.
This coming weekend is the Brooklyn Comics Festival, which takes place in Williamsburg this weekend. A lot of great artists will be in town for this. Chris Ware, Charles Burns. And are you going to be at the fair as well?
I'm going to be there, yeah. I'll be there basically just hanging out in the afternoon at Drawn and Quarterly's booth signing books. And
this is the third year now, and it's getting better every year. But I also think because of Sandy and because of what just, you know, the city's been through this week. I mean, they canceled the marathon, but they can't cancel the Brooklyn Comics Festival.
That's the city with the right priorities.
So I think that this weekend it should be a really kind of an amazing way for people to come together. It's an important event.
Yeah, there'll be a lot of non-comics talk for a change. I think everybody kind of wants to hear from each other how things went and how they're doing, and so I think that'll be a difference this year. But yeah, it's I think at this point it's probably my favorite American comics convention.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you on that one. You know, WFMU had to cancel its record fair. We do an annual record fair, and that was
going to be
this week. Oh, yeah, it's terrible, which means the station took a very large hit. We were doing a silent fundraiser online for the month of October, and we've had to continue this. We're going into disaster marathon mode, and if you go to the WFMU playlist page, our audience can figure out ways in which they can help support the station and get us through this trying time. But all of our staffers are safe. Everyone made it through, and there's a lot of people in need all across the region, but WFMU certainly will need some support to get through this as well. But Adrian, Tamina, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me, and I'll probably see you this weekend, I hope.
Yeah, all right. Thanks again, Adrian.
All right, take care. Bye, Benjamin.
Mitt Romney's Mormon faith was hardly a factor in the 2012 presidential campaign. The candidate spent more time talking about his tax returns than his religion. Perhaps he was wary of scaring the evangelical base of the Republican Party with the wild prophecies of Joseph Smith or fantastic tales about the Mormon planet of Kaloub. Or perhaps there was something else. All young Mormon men are required to go on an overseas mission when they turn 18. And Mitt Romney was no exception. And in 1968, he went to France.
What happened was, is that Mitt Romney, as it's now well documented, was rejected. He would go door to door as Mormon missionaries are supposed to do. People would slam the door to his face.
That's Sylvain Gir, a French radio producer I met in Paris when I went to investigate Romney's French past. Sylvain Gir's mother, Madeleine, encountered Romney on the streets of Paris. And this encounter, Gir told me, brought Mitt Romney face to face with one of the leading revolutionaries of the 20th century, Guy Debord. This is the story that should have been the October surprise of October surprises.
Mitt Romney first was in Le Havre, in the coast, the northern coast of France, in Normandy, and then he was in Bordeaux. But in May 68, he was in Bordeaux, and he had to accomplish a mission in Paris. But because of the general strike, he was unable to go back to Bordeaux. There was no gas in gas stations. The trains were not working. There was a general strike. It is actually the biggest general strike in France modern history. I think the number of people on strike is estimated between 5 to 6 million. You know, that about half of the working forces. But all France was on strike. It was not only a student's riots, as it is pictured now. It was a general worker strikes, together with students rioting and fighting with the police every night in the streets of Paris, where the universities were. My mother was also forced to stay in Paris, but that was okay with her. And she met this young American kid. He was crying, he was afraid, he was far from home. You know, he was alone, he was frightened. But then my mother, because of her pro-American feelings, you know, though she was more liberal, but she had these strong American feelings, my mother would open the door to Americans and feed them.
So hold on a second. Did he knock on the door, like telling her about the Mormon religion, and then start crying? What happened?
I don't know. Maybe he was crying because of the tear gas. Maybe he was crying because he was far away from home, you know, kind of E.T. situation. I don't remember exactly the circumstances. Now, for what has happened between them, because obviously this is what you want to know, my mother would be very quiet and shy about that. What I can tell you is that at this time, she had a close relationship, as one would say, with the famous radical thinker Guy Debord, the man who is now considered as the man who started May 68, who started the revolt. Now, Guy Debord, to put it briefly, is a radical thinker and avant-garde artist. He's the founder of the famous movement International Situationist International, that then had branches in the US and everywhere in Europe. Now, he was obviously fighting the police every night with his friends. But he was also, as it's been later known by his famous autobiography called Panégyrique in French, he was a drunk, okay? He was a heavy, heavy drinker. He would drink most of the time. So one night, Guy Debord is hiding from the police. He's been fighting them. He's run, you know, he's chased by the police in the streets of Paris. He ends up in my mother, Madeleine's apartment. And this is where history collides in a most incredible way. Imagine that. You have this woman, Madeleine, gorgeous woman, 30 years old, beautiful, good cook, nice, big heart. And then you have, on the left, this Guy Debord, radical thinker, you know, many women at his feet, like the top of his generation. Brilliant guy. And you have this young kid, 19, 20-year-old, this young American kid, Mitt Romney, a Mormon missionary. Can you imagine that? As the family story goes, my mother cooked for them. This is what you do in France. Anyway, you have people over, you cook. She would start with a salad, then a vegetable soup, then probably a good piece of meat. But because of the strikes, there might be restrictions. But you have this thing in Lyon that you can do very good meal with a few things from scratch, you know, almost what's left over in the fridge. So she would cook for her. I mean, I think lover, Guy Debord, and this young man, Mitt Romney. Now, after dinner, I think they would have argued about the war in Vietnam and many things. And as the story goes, Guy triggered Mitt in this kind of drinking contest, starting with wine. I think there were a few bottles of wine, you know, red wine from Burgundy, which has always been his favorite. Then moving along, you know, with pastis, this terrible drink from Marseille that can drive people crazy, you know. It's the, think of pastis as the illegitimate hair of absinthe, you know. And then through, like, country own preparation, you know, eau de vie, gnôle, that would be per spirit, you know, things like that, distilled alcohol, maybe whiskey, maybe vodka. At the point, it's difficult to make out.
So why would Mitt Romney participate in this contest since, you know, he's a Mormon, a young man who's never had a drop of alcohol in his life?
Pour les beaux yeux de Madeleine. For the sweet eyes of my mother, Madeleine. I can't see any reasonable explanation other than this one. You know, is this man, is young, is, you know, Guy looks like, I mean, really, he's been drinking for months now. He started a revolution. He's really arrogant, as he always was. I mean, Mitt, in all his innocence, you know, of a 20-year-old, thinks, I don't know, he would probably kind of what you guys call a jock at this point. He would say, I'm going to win this thing. So he entered the drinking contest. Guy Debord, as you can read in Panégyrique, there is a beautiful chapter. Everyone should read that because it's the most beautiful French language. I guess the English translation is beautiful too. Guy Debord can drink for months entirely in a row. So, I mean, at this point, he would outdrink anybody, especially a 20-year-old Mormon who never drank a single drop of alcohol in his life. But there is another contest that took place, which is even more interesting, a competition between those two men about slogans. You remember that Guy Debord and the Situationist in general were famous for their slogans. Guy Debord would come up with Sous les pavés la plage, under the stones the sound is under the stones. Now Guy Debord was always bragging about that because in the 50s he already came up with the famous slogan, never work. So during the course of the evening, Mitromne was kind of fed up with Guy going on and on about his slogans. I guess at this point, Mitromne is really drunk. So he goes in the street of Paris, he's drunk, he's angry, he's jealous, he wants to make a point. So he will fight Debord slogan for slogan. And my mother can still remember some of the most beautiful slogans that Mitromne came up with on this night. There's get rich, there's conform, conform, conform. And I think, and also as he was, you know, in this bath of French culture and poetry and alliteration, he would come up with beautiful things such as prophet, profit, you know, prophet and profits. So my mother doesn't remember exactly the saying, but that goes like that, you know, prophet and profits. Very good one. So, obviously, what should happen is that Mitromne lost this competition. You know, he's absolutely too drunk. He can't make it. He can't stand it. I think he pukes all over the place. It's a terrible mess. He ends up sleeping on a couch, and my mother is Guy Debord. The following day, guilt kicks in, obviously. Guilt kicks in, he's in a bad state, he doesn't want to look anybody in the eyes, he just gets up, gets dressed and leaves. And there, in the street of Paris, are his slogans. Imagine that. It's Paris, May 68, the early hours, the smell of tear gas lingering in the streets, barricades everywhere, the streets are empty and deserted, and this young man, you know, is stumbling through the street, but at the same time, everywhere he looks, in the neighborhood, in like four or five streets around my mother's place, he can see his slogans, he can see his writings on the wall. Get rich, conform, profits, prophet. I mean, that must have been such an encouragement for him, you know. That must have been terribly uplifting for this young man. Maybe at this moment he realized that one day his name would be on the wall or in the sky.
One of my favorite radio producers, Scott Carrier, has lived for years in Salt Lake City. And so I called him up to find out what he thinks it'll be like if Mitt Romney becomes president. Will there be even more giddiness and glee?
Well, Mormons have always, you know, clung very tightly to their beliefs that basically that Joseph Smith, you know, was a prophet and what he said was true. And everybody's always said, no, no, you're insane. That's ridiculous. But if Romney wins, I mean, to some extent, a lot of Mormons are going to feel like, now see, we were right all along. And, you know, if they're right all along, that means that basically that we are in the latter days. You know, they call themselves the Latter-day Saints because they believe we're living in the latter days of the last dispensation of time, which ends when Jesus comes back, which is going to be soon. That's what Joseph Smith believed, anyway. And he thought it might be, even be in his own lifetime. He ran for president in 1844 when he was 39 with a platform to annex Texas, free the slaves, close all the jails, and reduce the size of the government by turning it into a theocracy. But his campaign was cut short in June when he was killed, shot by an angry mob in jail, when he was in jail. Yeah. So he never made it. But, you know, his fame, Joseph Smith's story, was that Jesus guided the hands of our founding fathers in writing the Constitution to make sure, you know, to create a country that protected religious liberties so that Joseph Smith could be born and grow up to restore the gospel, found a new church, and that would, you know, prepare the way for the return of Jesus. Jesus, you know, their idea is that Jesus created America to have a place he could live when he comes back. And that's, you know,
is that
disconcerting in a way, because if he comes back, Mormons believe that he would come back to this place about 60 miles northeast of Kansas City. But other Mormons believe he'll come back here and live in the Salt Lake Temple. And then other Mormons just say, that's ridiculous. We don't know where he's going to live. We don't know anything. Just that he's coming back. But there are Mormons who believe that he's going to live here in Salt Lake City in the temple, which is just down the street from my house.
So you're saying...
yeah, I don't know. It's a little weird.
So you're saying you don't want Jesus as a neighbor?
No, I would welcome him with open arms. I think it would be great. I have no problem with Jesus. It's just the idea that they've always believed that they're chosen people. If Mitt Romney wins, it's going to make them, you know, somewhat more confident in those beliefs. And that's just kind of bothersome to me.
Yeah,
the
idea
of chosen people, any chosen people, is a troubling belief to me. Chosen people in promised land is, I think, just archaic notion.
What would it be like? what do you fear it would be like? Like, that's, I mean, this overconfidence, how would that translate into what your daily life would be like?
I don't know. I don't want to sound bigoted or prejudiced. And,
you know,
Mormons, when it come right down to it, they're like people everywhere, you know. Some are good, some are bad, some are really smart, some aren't. And so it's different. But, you know, you said, you described, you used the words giddy and glee. And I think that's not inaccurate. Mormons do have this, you know, aura of happiness, almost a glow about them at times. And when I see that, when I run into it, you can see it really easily down at Temple Square. The people who work there, who volunteer to take visitors around, they have this glow about them. And, you know, when I see that, it's like, it doesn't really upset me. It's kind of fun in a way. I mean, to see it, it's not really necessarily an upsetting thing, but it's like a little creepy. Why are these people so happy? Why are they full of glee? You know, it seems wrong somehow to me. And living and surrounded by people who feel that way, when I usually don't, I don't really feel that way most of the time. It's just, it's like they're having a party and you're really not, you don't want to be there.
And so when you combine this with them being giddy about Romney, their man in the White House, you think it would just be over the top? Like, what would change? If they're already beaming and glowing, how could it get worse?
Right, exactly. I don't know. It'll definitely go up another notch, but I think I can still take it, maybe. I just don't know where I would go. I kind of like living here. It's never been a problem before, you know, because we have Mormon senators and congressmen, but their votes are balanced by many others. It's just that the president, Mormon president, is a little bit disconcerting.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot.
The Constitution says there will be no religious test for public office. And according to that, Romney's religious beliefs should be off the table, not a matter of public discussion. And Thomas Jefferson said, it makes no difference whether my neighbor believes in 20 gods or no god. It neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. I think that's what he said, approximately. And, you know, that's what America's all about, religious liberties. And so I want to believe that. I want to believe that Romney's not going to be anything new or different because, I mean, the idea that God blesses America above all other nations, that's manifest destiny. That's, you know, 200 years old at least. And there have been other presidents, maybe all of our presidents have asked for and received God's help in making difficult decisions. You know, so maybe I'm trying to think Romney's not going to be any different necessarily. But then if a president believes that our future has already been foretold and that, you know, it's like the apocalypse, that we're living in the final days, the apocalypse, and why would you try to stop global warming? It's part of God's plan. Or why would you try to stop war in the Middle East if it's destined? These things bother me. You know, I think maybe they do pick my pocket and break my leg, if not my balls.
Remember how a few months ago there were all these stories about the vast amount of money that the right-wing super PACs were going to pour into the Romney campaign?
Yeah, the fear was that all this money would enable Romney to buy more ads and swamp Obama. But he's raised about the same amount of money. I think they've each spent about $1 billion.
Yeah, but most of this money isn't being spent on advertising.
Where's it going then?
Polls. So a couple days after the first debate, I get a call from a friend of mine, old buddy of mine. He used to work at the Pentagon, and now he's got this boutique polling agency, and they are totally swamped. So he calls me to ask if I got time to do some work with him.
Wait, so now you're a pollster?
Well, dude, it's not like you need a license for this sort of thing. It's actually pretty easy. And both campaigns are more than willing to fork over serious cash for poll data right now.
Wait, are you saying that pollsters just make stuff up?
No, we're doing polls. It's just that they're super selective and narrow. So, for example, I did one where I called a bunch of hair salons that cater to older women in Salt Lake City. And, you know, got some serious Romney insight on that one.
What, like 100% Romney?
It's not as one-sided as you'd guess. Another one, company asked us to do a poll for people who are registered medical marijuana recipients in Colorado. And this one also was not as one-sided as you'd think.
So you're basically telling me you're like one of the guys skewing with the data.
No, this is kind of the way they've been done since the beginning. And a bunch of the major ones, for example, don't even call people with cell phones. I mean, think how many people you know that don't even have a landline anymore. So that's going to skew your results. What's really crazy, though, what I've learned consulting for my buddy's polling company is that this election, it isn't about Obama and Romney. It isn't about two different visions for America. It's really about two different ideas about polling.
What do you mean?
This election is a referendum on Karl Rove and Nate Silver. As we head into the final days of the campaign, Nate Silver on his 538 blog has Obama's odds of winning at like 85%. And this is driving the Republican establishment crazy because he's totally destroying the narrative that this is a close race.
Exactly how does Nate Silver do what he does?
Well, he's stated a number of times that there's no secret sauce. I mean, everything in his algorithm is available. He uses polling data. He uses economic data. He uses demographic trends. And it's all in a large algorithm. But, you know, he's very transparent, and he runs 10,000 runs a day and aggregates them and takes averages. and then he reports whatever it is his algorithm says. And having just been doing the polling thing myself for the past month, I can tell you he's telling the truth. It's all just math.
Hasn't it always been about math?
No, the Republicans hate math, just like they hate science. They have the same attitude about math as they do about evolution.
They don't believe in it.
Exactly. I mean, think about Karl Rove. He's like the guru. He's the leader of the approach that's how the Republicans do polling. And it's like a dark art, you know. Remember Bush called him the architect in 2004.
So what is he doing then? Like anti-math?
Well, he says he has the math.
What does that even mean?
I think it just means he fiddles with the numbers until it looks like his candidate is going to win.
But wait a minute. Didn't both Nate Silver and Karl Rove predict the same outcome in 2008?
Yes. They both predicted basically the same thing, an Obama super win. Rove got two states wrong. Silver got one state wrong. But this time, they're both predicting wildly different scenarios. Silver's predicting an 85% chance of an Obama win. Rove is predicting Romney will win at least 279 electoral college votes and 51% of the popular vote to Obama's 48.
Who then has the right math?
Well, if Romney wins, it doesn't mean that Silver's model is wrong. It just means that the data is wrong. But if Obama wins, this totally blows up the Republican model, okay? An Obama win throws a brick into the whole Republican works. It means that this race was never close. It means that the country isn't as polarized as they like to say it is. It means that demographics are changing. That means that the country really is moving to the left. And that means that the Republican Party is on its way to becoming irrelevant. And that means that Karl Rove is irrelevant.
So, wait a minute. What does it mean then if Romney wins?
It means the Republicans stole it.
This episode of Too Much Information is called October Surprises. It was produced by myself, Benjamin Walker, with Bill Bowen. It featured Adrian Tomina, Sylvain Gier, Scott Carrier, and TMI's special correspondent, Chris. There's links and more information on the TMI playlist page, and that's where you can find information on how to subscribe to the TMI podcast as well. While the Hudson River came within 50 feet of WFMU's front door, the station miraculously didn't flood. But the damage to WFMU from Hurricane Sandy is extensive. Once the electricity was returned, we discovered essential computer and broadcasting equipment that was damaged by the electricity failing and then surging before finally going out altogether. Both of our transmitters remain without power, all of our phone lines and audio circuits remain down, and the majority of our internet connections needed to broadcast over the web are out of commission. We've been broadcasting online using makeshift equipment and connections, but we need your help to stay online and to return once again to the FM airwaves. WFMU has never been in such a cash-poor position as we are right now. Our annual record fair also had to be canceled this past weekend due to Sandy. Please give as generously as you can to our hurricane recovery campaign. More information on the homepage at WFMU.org. And please urge your friends and family to do the same.
And this is WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, on the web at WFMU.org. And I can give an update to what Benjamin just told you. We are now back on the air on 91.1 FM. Congratulations to Ken and everybody that has been helping try and solve our immediate broadcast problems. But we do urge you to please go to our homepage, WFMU.org, and make a generous pledge to help with all the difficulties that we are going through right now. Stay tuned. Coming up next, it's Nardwar, the Human Serviette, with a band from Detroit, Michigan, Death.
Nardwar! 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 Nardwar!
Pushers and pimps trying to make me straight, serving me death on a silver tray. They get on my nerves, wasting my time, offering me dope, sex and crime. But I hang tough and stand up tall. I look them in the eye and I tell them all, get out my face, you low down cat. I'm a different breed, I ain't into that. Pills, no foolish thrills, no alcohol, no cool menthol, no smoking weed, no dirty deed, no drug abuse, no jive excuse.
I ain't into that.
No staying out late, no drowning in hate, no turning tricks just for kicks. No butcher knife, no taking life, no skipping school, no acting the fool.
I ain't into that.
No going to jail, ain't got no bail, no stealing cars, no hopping bars, no shacking up, no getting down, no hanging out, no standing around.
I ain't into that.
No driving drunk, no classes flunked, no throwing stones, no breaking bones, no dipping snuff and all that stuff, no carrying a gun just for fun. I just ain't into that. The old, no hot stuff sold, no busting heads, ending up dead, no having babies before I'm ready, no being a parent when too young to go steady. I definitely ain't into that. Now listen, you can call me square if you dare, but that's alright, cause I don't care. Call me a fool, say my head is fat, but that's all right, cause I ain't into that. Now I've made up my mind, I know what to do, and no matter what, I'm gonna see it through. I'm gonna get a hit every time at bat, and believe it or not, I'm into that. Educate and graduate, get a job instead of rob. I'm gonna be a man and take a stand, feel good inside and show some pride. I'm into that. I'm gonna learn some skills and earn some bills, make a career and get out of here. I'm gonna help somebody cause I am somebody. Do what's right, not be uptight. Now, I'm into that. Study my stuff even if it's rough. Stand the test when the going gets tough. Obey the law, the golden rule. Study hard and stay in school. Man, I'm into it.
because I care. Be neat and clean whenever I'm seen. Have a friend, stick to the end. I'm into that. I'm gonna hang in there until I get somewhere. Shine my light and be out of sight. Trust in God wherever I trod. Early rise and exercise. Now I'm deep, deep in the bed. Yes, I am real deep. I'm gonna make something great out of myself. Take my talents off of the shelf. I'm gonna get a hit every time at bat. And believe it or not, I'm into that. You can say what you want, but I'm into that. Call me anything you want to call me, but I'm into it. All the way. I'm into that.